missiles don't seem to be livening things up. I know today's activity was not terribly amazing to me. 10 meters was very local propagation conditions. I could only see signals from very local. There was no DXing. There was no kind of wonderful propagation going on. And the rest of the bands were kind of in a lull as well. I mean, some of that has to do with whether or not there are contests. I assume there was no contest this weekend because I didn't see any contest-like activity. So it seems like an unfortunate, quiet weekend for the HF band. Now, other people probably saw something different. They might have much better antenna systems than me or much more sensitive front ends than me, but that's the way I saw it.
I've been monitoring activity on HF for a few days. I don't have a good antenna, but I remember the times when I was young and there was, you know, a piece of wire or just a piece of wire connected to the cooling system pipe or the heating system pipe, radiators. And there was beautiful tons of stations on all of the bands. Today I was I saw almost nothing on 3.5, which is 80 meters. Very little on 40 meters. Almost not present in 20 meters. 18 nothing. 21 megahertz nothing. And 28 megahertz nothing. How did that experience differs with you having a good antenna? And to Xia.
Well, I don't know. I think the difference is not you having a bad antenna and me having a great, wonderful antenna. It's you having a not-so-great antenna and me having a medium kind of antenna. You know, guys down in places like Florida that have these towers with multiple multi-Yagi band arrays and phased connections and such probably get a much different view of the amateur radio world than we do. Probably what would be useful is for you to kind of check into beacon technology, whisper and otherwise, and get even a better sense of how the signals are propagating. There's a lot of those online, so they'll give you a somewhat more detailed view of what transmissions in what area and what frequencies are getting beyond a certain point. So you might want to avail yourself of that modern technology. You know, some people use it to hunt down stations, but you know, you can investigate propagation conditions alone using those types of tools.
Actually, I acquired two extremely good devices. One is 3586B, which is selective level meter. So it's like a voltmeter, but it does have an excellent stability, 1, 2, 3, 4 digits, after zero stability of frequency. So it's 3586B selective level meter HP, and it's a device that has a single sideband and ability to measure exactly in dBm, dBpw, and dB per 0.775 volt, which would be the equivalent of it. So, and that was what I was using to measure the signals. But I have a few words about something else. How do we know if there is going to be a propagation or is not going to be a propagation on HF bands? So I mentioned about sudden ionospheric disturbances, which is SID events. And it's for a very low frequency range that actually allows us to know what's going on in the frequencies up to 50 megahertz. So it works this way, that a solar flare occurs on the sun and blast of intense ultraviolet and X-ray radiation hits the day side of the air after a propagation time of about 8 minutes, and this high energy radiation is absorbed by atmospheric particles, raising them to the excited state and knocking electrons free in the process of photoionization. The low altitude ionosphere layers, which would be the D and E region, immediately increased in density over the entire day size. The ionospheric disturbance enhances VLF radio propagation, and of course scientists or ham radio amateur scientists can use this enhancement to detect solar flares by monitoring the signal strength of the distance VLF transmitter using the receiver. So we have a network of the transmitters, and then if the extra radiation happened 8 minutes later, we don't have a propagation at all, and that could stay for quite a few days. And interesting is how that measurement is done. Well, the signal could go following the curvature of the air, which would be the ground wave, and the same signal from the same transmitter could go through the D layer and bounce back to any antenna that is receiving it. And then if a network of those transmitters and receivers is spotting that event that is happening, so it takes only 8 minutes to travel to our air from the sun, and then we no longer have that propagation. But of course we have 11 years sun period, but that is something like a steady event. But apart from that, we have those solar flare disturbances. That would be actually what I wanted to say, because the network is working approximately at 26.1 kilohertz. And I believe most of ham radio amateur transceivers, they have a receiver that goes that low. And interesting thing is that there is a software that costs only like a $45, and that's by the Space Research Society in England, but actually it's called UKRAA, and they created a waterfall a software that is allowing people to predict what's going to happen with the propagation tomorrow, after tomorrow, and a week from now. And to XGN. Back to you.
Okay, I'm unaware of that predictive nature. You know, spurts from the sun are spasmodic, and as far as I'm aware, unpredictable. And can be very dangerous. There was a reported in history back when there were Morse code wired transmissions. The wiring shorted out and burnt out all over the darn place. One could only imagine what a similar cosmic burst would do to satellite systems and not terribly hardened electronics across the country. They even, I think, made a bad television series about that subject that didn't last very long. So, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of different ways that terrible things can happen. I'm, again, unfamiliar with the predictive nature of low-frequency emissions and how they reflect on the next few days. unfortunately, that's sort of like the weather. There's not much you can do about it. It's whatever happens, happens. You can't change things. I've mentioned before that I think the erratic nature of amateur radio transmissions is one of the allures. If you could rely upon contacting someone in Singapore at any time on the radio, it would basically just be a cell phone, and I don't know if people would take the time or trouble to exercise their right to have a hobby to do such a thing. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you about that. So, it's interesting information. We'll see what becomes of it, and I hope the sunspot activity continues to get better. It should. There will be down days. There will be up days. As I mentioned before, there's some kind of tropospheric ducting in my neighborhood that lets the Pennsylvania repeater that operates at 146.850 break through every so often. So, you know, some propagation is happening. Some good, and not terribly useful to me.
I agree with you. There are a number of ways that we can gather the information if we need them, but that British Association made a very, very much inexpensive and available software that can give the information right on the spot. I see the price is $39.95. That group of people is associated with the British British telescopes. I have to find more about it. But anyhow, that one of the software is called Radio Eyes, and it does give all of the information about not only solar activity, but that would be interesting for the people interested with the space, the separate pulsar catalog, customizable catalogs of radio objects, the background BAPT, antenna beam objects, and drift scan tables, track objects. I'm reading GPL, F-Matrix data, planets, and everything in here. But it's not what I was trying to talk about. It. There is just another way to enjoy the hobby. Just simply tune to the quiet sun. Interesting that is quiet sun is just those transmitters that they call them quiet sun. They are at frequency 26.7 kilohertz. The one is in Turkey. The other one at 21.75 kilohertz is in Rosny, France. They have in Tavlora at 20.76. And simply by listening to them and knowing that you can hear them or not, you can have, without any waterfall, any program, you can have an idea what the propagation is like for today. So in other words, is after the sudden event happens, 8 minutes later, the propagation is over. Of course, you have a day-night differentiation with the propagation, but it's over. I'm going to send you the link to the article. The antenna is very small if somebody wants to build it. Do you know something about magnetic loop antennas? It looks like a vertical four-square four corners, cubic antenna, a very small one. And I was very much puzzled, how is that possible that such a small antenna has a self-resonant frequency at 20 kilohertz. And to XGF.
WB2KWC? Yes, Cap. Okay, there are a few things that Wesley mentioned that I want to comment on. I am mostly a CW op, so the tools I'm going to talk about are CW. If you're looking at, for the sunspot forecast, if you go on the first page of QRZ.com, there is usually a solar forecast there. I have found lately that 40 meters is doing a lot better than 20 meters, making a lot more contacts on 40 than 20, except for contests, but that's not really propagation, that's just, the mad rush of a contest. Also, rather than using propagation forecasts, a tool that I use is reverse beacon. If you go to beta.reversebeacon.net, and then all you've got to do is either send CQ, DE, and your call, or test DE and your call a few times. If you go there, enter your call, you will see how you are being picked up by various monitoring stations around the world, and they'll even do a projected path on a map of the United States or the world, depending on where you're getting out to. AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Thank you, Ken. Yeah, I mean, the point is that there's a lot of different options available to get a good assessment of propagation. And, you know, Wesley, if you found another one, that's great. I don't think anyone really ultimately should depend upon one single method. Reverse beacons are useful. Beacons are useful. Joe Taylor, once again, along with all the other great things he's come up with, has the Whisper Network, which is a series of beacons that can be visualized on a web page. And I don't know, unless you don't like web pages or unless you don't like these different technological devices, I think they're all valuable, useful, and give you a better understanding. And again, I have not been very thrilled with 20 meters for many years now. It's been kind of taking a dirt nap. I am hoping that as 10 meters and certainly 6 meters comes to life, as the sunspot cycle comes into its maximum, 20 meters is going to be a lot more active than it has been. To me, 40 meters is probably the best of all worlds, at least at this point. It has activity during the night. It has some activity during the day. Whereas, as I mentioned before, 80 and 160 goes to sleep at dawn and wakes up when the sun starts to set. I think 40 meters has been, for me, the go-to band during this portion of sunspot minimum.
Yeah, interesting is how the scientists, but also ham radio amateurs, are estimating what is the condition of the HF band. You have one transmitter, and it transmits the signal. It could go two ways. So one would be to have to D-layer and then bounce back, and the other one would be to the ground wave. And then you measure the time of arrival, and then you know if it bounced from E layer or D layer. And then you can create a dispersion pattern, because one signal comes with a little delay. And by that, you can have additional information. And to XGF.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, let me see if I have the signal. Okay. Theoretically, yes. In practical terms, there's always some complications. There are some bands that do not reflect off of of ionization layers. 80 meters does not really reflect well off of the D layer. When the D layer is highly energized, a lot of it is the RF is absorbed in that layer rather than being refracted back. So there are complications, but yeah, there are all kinds of interesting indicators of what propagation ionospheric layers are active and not active. NASA and a whole bunch of other scientists work on that in general because it's not just amateur radio-centric. It affects other forms of communication and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of literature about different ionization bands and how they're affected at different times, and they're all reported. So yeah, more information is always better than less information, but I would try not to kind of decide that one method is the be-all, end-all. I think a lot of different methods add to the soup.
KG2R1. Absolutely agree with that. But that information that I gave about time of arrival and the dispersion pattern was related to VLF radios that are easily to be monitored by every ham radio operator because they are at 20 to 24 kilohertz, and those frequencies are very much in brackets of such a test. So that would be the D layer or E layer reflection, and that would be another part, which would be the ground wave, and then there is a comparison between the two at the receiver. And that could be also done at ham radio receiver, although I don't know how we can, apart from just hearing the delay, which would be very minimum, how we could possibly make some data out of it. Into Exia.
KD2FIU, there are three concepts to relieve the delay.
Okay, George, but first David, I think, wanted to say something. So first David, and then we'll get back to you, George, okay?
Good evening, Wes and Roy, and just wanted to say that I hardly ever go to those websites where you find out what the overall propagation status, you know, how well the signals are traveling for whatever reason, whatever purpose. What I do is my favorite bands, 40, 20, 17, and 10, on the parts of the bands that I like to use, I'll put memory function channels every 5 to 10 kilohertz up and down the band. So when I turn my radio on, I can just very quickly go through all of it, and signals will be audible, but they're not going to be there. And I do that at least 4 or 5 times a day. If there's action, you know, I guess I'll know.
Okay, I mean, there's more than one way to skin a rat, and there's more than one way of seeing whether propagation conditions are worth your trouble of trying to make contact. The simplest approach is to simply go to those frequencies and call out and wait for a response. If there are known signals that you receive, listening for them gives you more information that way. And if you want to avail yourself of beacon and reverse beacon and whisper data, that's up to you. Some people do it religiously, others never look at it and couldn't care less. So it's better that it's available for those people who want to use it, and for those people who don't, use whatever method works for them best.
W2VZ.
Okay, Rich, you're next after George, I guess. So, George, you wanted to make a comment.
The concept of echo and echo return and delay and all of that has more complex control. There is VTL via transmission loss, there's VNL via network loss, there's opening the circuit, actually not listening to what's coming back to you as you're transmitting, and there's also echo cancellation, phase cancellation, so that as you're transmitting, an out phase of signal is going out, so you're not hearing the out phase of signal coming back at you. So, and also it goes within your equipment. Your equipment can have an echo delay function for a capacitive control, so that as you're converting from different circuits, I don't want to go into it, Roy. Sorry. Let the next station go, because the concepts here have to do with audio presentation, and I don't want to go into all of that right now, but you can control what's hearing coming back at you with many different ways that were developed over the last, 80 years.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that you're coming.
Well, ditto, George. Thank you for that. Rich, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, different radio, different position in the apartment, so I hope you can hear me okay. I mean, is it true that if 10 is wide open, 17's going to be wide open, or not wide open, but open, as 15 and 20 will be also? In other words, you know, the higher you go, and the more open a band is, the ones below it are going to be open too. Would that be a good indicator? I remember I used to use that method when I was a kid. Go ahead.
Yeah, to a degree, the same things work. As long as above and below are not that large a difference in frequency. You know, the one right below 20 is 30 that most people don't use, but really the next one is 40, so you can't use it for, you know, if 20 is lively, 40 must be lively. But yeah, theoretically, when ionization conditions are sufficient such that 10 meters is open up for distant propagation, you're going to see a benefit going percolating down to 17 meters and even 20 meters. It's going to have a destructive influence, though, on 40, 80, and 160. But yeah, as long as you keep it reasonable, you can assume that other nearby frequencies will be able to have the same propagation improvement by heightened ionization.
KD2VEW.
10, 15, 17, and 20. As a group, and you know, nothing below that. You're right, Roy. You know, 40. If that doesn't affect 40 or 80 or 160. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, after you work these things year in and year out, you get a certain sense of what band will be open during the summer and the winter, during the dawn and the dusk. And, you know, it's one of those things that you just kind of factor into the equation. And then every so often it all gets blown apart by some strange propagation like tropospheric ducting or something else. Now, Frank, who is on Echolink, WB2BXO, would like to add something to this. But we need to keep the push to talk quiet for a little while, because Echolink is very sensitive. And I heard you, Mike. I'll go to you right after we're done with Frank.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, if anybody's EchoLink, apparently, at least on my phone, will only keep, if nobody else is keying, the repeater. In any case, what I tried a couple of nights ago is I made an FT8 contact using a remote station in Connecticut, running about 75 watts to an off-center effect dipole. And I then looked on PSK Reporter and put it last 30 minutes, FT8, 30 meters, and got back a world map showing where my FT8 signal had been received. And of course, since I had just worked a station in the Ukraine, I wasn't surprised that I'd been received all over Europe. But I was surprised to see two stations in the Tokyo area had decoded my FT8 signal, because it was kind of early in the, it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon in Tokyo. So, I mean, that's very similar to what you can do with RBN on CW. But FT8 is very interesting for seeing what propagation is doing, though a lot of people argue it isn't, those aren't real contacts. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are guys who sit there with clipboards saying, this is ham radio, this isn't ham radio, this isn't, this is. The fact that you are using computer algorithms heavily, as much as RF principles, annoys people. The fact that you can sort of accomplish this with less effort, guys who had to use other means years earlier would dedicate many, many hours in front of the radio. I have friends who, you know, either watch television, listen to the radio, broadcast radio, or read a book while they're doing FT8. You can almost set it up to automatically function, which annoys the heck out of a lot of amateur radio operators. But, you know, if it gives you enjoyment, then so be it. And again, I think more information is far better than less information. Now, the fact that an FT8 signal gets to a certain point, you really can't extrapolate that even to CW. It really can be received under the noise floor, which even CW can't. So as long as you keep in mind the modality you're using to transmit, and kind of auto-correct for that, the extra information is certainly good to have. I'm always for more, not less, information.
Yeah, I realize that. Yeah, unfortunately, using a shared resource, like a remote ham radio station, I can't sit there all day and let the station work people. I know there are guys doing that. Anyway, and I realize, of course, yeah, that just because stations in Japan were decoding me below the noise level does not necessarily mean I could have worked them. Higher noise level in our part of the world at times, I might not have heard or decoded them. You know, the same reason we hear DX on 40 meters at 4 in the afternoon, and we're unable to work it on ordinary modes like CW and sideband. Anyway, Roy, I'll let you move on to Mike. I did not want to jump the line here. One other quick FT8 question, when you can get to it in turn, is I've been told that on the Flex radios, you're better off turning the AGC off, since the FT8 algorithm has AGC built in. I was wondering if you were familiar with that at all. Go on to the next guy in the meantime, WB2B itself.
Okay, very good, Frank. KD2BDW, Mike, you wanted to say something.
Thanks, Roy. I had a question I was trying to get in, so let's see. Hopefully somebody can. I'm sure you have the answer. So basically, my G90, the remark is that thing can tune in. It can anything. So what I tried is an end-fed wire about 37 foot, no on, no balance, directly connected to a B connector with an adapter, and it could tune it at 6 to 1. Today it was 11 to 1 with an on, but still it tuned it while the KX2 couldn't tune it. My question is if I do that wire to a, like a banana plug BNC adapter into the back of the radio, and it tunes at such a high SWR down to 1.2, is there any effect on the radio?
Okay, there shouldn't be, unless it's a multi-designed radio. Radios for many years have been built with protection circuits. If you have too much of a mismatch that's producing a high reflected power going back into your final power transistors, it will lower the power to the safe mode. So you shouldn't worry too much. The problem is with these high VIS-WAS, correcting them at the feed line is the most efficient way of dealing with it. You can theoretically build a transmat of some kind, an impedance matching circuit at your shack that could adjust any ridiculous impedance to a nominal 50 ohms. The problem is that you introduce problems on the transmission line of multiple reflections, which cause attenuation of power. So you get a much less efficient signal out by doing all of the impedance matching at the site of your shack as opposed to the feed point. So if at all possible, there are people who weatherproof their antenna tuners and place them at the B point purely for that reason, or they use much more lossless transmission lines like open wire, which has other problems that you can't get it near conducting metal. But all things being equal, I would try my best to do most of my impedance matching at the B point, if at all possible. And I wouldn't worry too much about mismatches to the transmitter unless, again, it's broken or very, very old or poorly engineered. It should have enough safety features to deal with all that.
Okay, yeah, that's because that was one of my questions. So if it's like, for example, if my tuner can tune it without the unon, what was the point of the unon? But I'm guessing not every wire, every antenna is tunable without the balun or the unun.
Well, once again, it depends upon the nature of your antenna tuner. They're not all created equal, especially internal antenna tuners built into Japanese radios are somewhat infamous for only correcting for about a 3-to-1 mismatch. It's a kind of a psychological thing. The Japanese don't think that people will have an antenna designed to be so poorly matched, so they don't spend the extra money to build something that will transform it that much. There are, like my Palstar, things that can transform anything. You can tune a doorknob. It's not going to make it a better antenna than it was as a doorknob, but it will tune it so it will look to be 50 ohms. And that's one of the problems, as I said before. If you have something like an NFET that happens to just randomly be a half wave, you're talking about an impedance of 2,000 to 3,000 ohms. Now, is it possible that you have an antenna tuner that's capable of taking 3,000 ohms and converting it to 50 ohms? Theoretically, yes. Should you do so? If you can do anything else? No, because again, the high mismatch before it gets to the antenna tuner is going to lead to an inefficiency in the transmission line that's going to transfer a lot of that energy into waste heat. So all things being equal, if you can't get your antenna tuner at the feed point, at least get a impedance transforming balance at the feed point to kind of get it closer to 50 ohms, if at all possible, as close to the antenna feed point as possible.
Okay, roger, roger. Yeah, I understand that. So the whole idea of this experiment, as I would call it, is if I'm in the woods and I need to get a signal out and my unbalanced breaks or it doesn't work, I mean, just as an emergency thing. So, okay, I'm not harming the radio, but I'm also not getting the most efficient signal.
Right. Thankfully, modern radios are practically built to bulletproof. There's a lot of foolish things that we do with hams. You know, we'll transmit we'll switch antennas and forgot that we switched them, and we'll transmit into a coax cable that's not connected to anything, or into one that's been shorted to ground. You know, normally a final transmitter amplification circuits do not like that. They get very angry with you. But modern day, you could do foolish things like that and usually get away with it. I wouldn't suggest you keep trying it, but thankfully, they're a lot more bulletproof than they were in the past.
Hey, Roy, thank you. Thank you for the thing. Yeah, like I said, you know, new ham here, so I bought the radio to get into the woods, and I've been doing a lot of park stuff, you know, practicing the woods, practicing different scenarios. But I thought somebody had mentioned that it does cause the radio to overwork. But thank you for the answer. I'll let the next person go, 73, and have a great week.
NY2A query.
Fading, and good luck, and enjoy the hobby, and if you have any other questions, or if you observe something that you'd like to share with us, please come back and do so.
NY2A query.
Yes, what is your query?
If I was to understand the setup, he was putting a random wire directly to the back with no feed line, so he's not suffering any loss whatsoever. He's essentially, the feed point is his antenna tuner, unless I misinterpreted what he was saying the setup is.
Okay, that's a good question. Mike, was it just the wire antenna itself that was going into the radio, or was there any kind of transmission line involved?
82 BDW. Yeah, it was one of those, you know, banana plugs. You know, you got the red and black plug, the wire to that, counterpoise off to the side, and then right into the radio. No coax in between.
Okay, so yeah, that's a little different. I mean, most applications I've seen have something of a transmission line. You wouldn't have the attenuation losses. Still, I don't know. You're asking a heck of a lot of your antenna tuner at some frequency ranges to deal with the possible uncorrected impedances of an NFET line.
Yeah, I will say that the Zygo G90, for all its, whatever it is, that tuner is unbelievably amazing. Like I said, today it's tuned at 11 to 1 mismatch.
Okay, that's good to hear. Like I've mentioned before, Chinese items, some of them are magical and some of them are terrible, and it's kind of impossible to tell ahead of time which one they are. Although usually consistently Chinese equipment has not the best user interfaces. They really have to have a chat or two with some people employed by Apple to get that aspect together. And of course, you know, when people say the impedance mismatch, it's a complicated thing because impedances are actually not absolute numbers, although we call them that all the time. You know, we say that when something's 50 ohms or it's 1,000 ohms. Complex impedances are both ohms of resistance and phase angles of how the current to voltage phases are in relation to each other. If the current and the phase relationship is zero, and the phase angle is zero, and it's a purely resistive impedance, and if the phase angles are 90 degrees, then it's either purely a reactive impedance. So it's a little bit more complicated. And Dick used to mention that what he would love is if manufacturers of antenna tuners would supply Smith charts that would not only indicate the impedances that can be matched, but more accurately, the impedances and the phase angles that can be matched. Because you could have two different impedances that read as, say, 1,000 ohms. And one might be 1,000 ohms with a phase angle of 0, the other a phase angle of 30. One might tune, the other might not tune. So everyone out there, keep that in mind, that impedance mismatches of pure absolute impedances is only part of what's going on.
All right, Rory, thank you so much. Yeah, as a beginner, I've got a lot to learn. So playing every day and having fun. Thanks, Rory, 73, and back to net.
You're welcome, Mike. As I say, this hobby is basically to have fun. If you're not having fun out there, you're doing it wrong. With that in mind, if there's anyone else out there with any questions of a technical nature or general science topics or generalized medical topics, please tell me your first name and your call sign and I'll put you on the list.
This is Joe KC2QYW, Joe from Harrison, New York. Late check-in. Back to the net.
Well, good as always to hear you, Joe. I assume this is just a check-in and not that you have any questions for the net tonight.
Yes, Roger, Roger. No questions tonight. Just listening. And yeah, I've been listening, and I just wanted to check in. And yeah, love you guys, and be safe. Back to the net.
Delta 2, Whiskey Oscar Tango, evening.
Yes, KD2WOT, what's your first name?
Sorry, Chris.
Okay, Chris, you got a question tonight?
Yes, Roy, I was wondering, I happened to send a copy of an article I discussed last week about the antenna line.
Yes, I got it. I haven't read it entirely. It's an interesting article. It sort of touches on things that we talked about last week, that introducing any wire down a long enough path will introduce a inductive impedance that might impede the dissipation of static electricity and other electricity that you're trying to get rid of at the antenna site. And there are different ways of dealing with it. My personal way of dealing with it is to use, rather than a cylindrical piece of wire, that some people will just go and get a very large gauge copper piece of wire, but there's more inductance in a cylindrical wire than there is in just a rectangular strap of copper. And so I bought copper, it's readily available at different places, and you can buy that strapping so that the amount of inductive impedance from one and a half stories high is kind of minimal. The article that you sent me was very interesting, in which they introduced the option of inserting a capacitance to neutralize the inductive impedance. And maybe if you're doing something at the, you know, two, three, four stories high, a capacitor in line with the coax cable the way it was shown might be useful. I tend to personally think it's a little overkill for a one-story distance. But, you know, a belt and suspenders, I see nothing inherently wrong in the design. Yeah, I mean, if you notice the specifications, they give you a very wide range for that that parallel capacitor. I forget exactly how wide, but when I was looking at it, I said, geez, that's basically just anything you find in the box, you could probably plug in with that spec. So, you know, he was playing kind of fast and loose, because, you know, if you use a large enough parallel capacitor, now you got a problem where your wire is now too capacitively reactive. So now that's another impedance. It's not that impossible to make things slightly worse using this particular technique. If you measure the inductive reactance and calculate a good capacitor to neutralize that effect, but then it varies with the frequency of the signal you're dealing with. So again, I think it's a fascinating article. I think it's an interesting design. I think I'm personally going to stick with my strapping.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you very much.
KD2FIU inquiry?
Yes, George.
I missed that. You're going to stick with your what?
Copper strap. I use copper strap from my first story window down to a copper rod that's driven into the ground.
I'm sorry, Roy, I missed the term. You said strapping. I missed it. KD2FIU clear. Thank you.
No problem, George. I prefer people understanding what I try and say. I realize that not every signal comes across perfectly crystal clear. Okay, once again, I'll repeat myself. I'm sure I said it last week, but for those people who tend to prefer using coax shielding for their ground strapping, that's perfectly fine if you're doing it in a weatherproof environment, like the inside of a weatherproof car. If you're using it outside where it's going to be exposed to rain and the elements, I would strongly urge something like copper strapping over coax shield, because they can corrode in the weather, and then each and every one of those metal contacts can end up being sources of nonlinear signal generation. You know, they all act as little crystal diodes, like a crystal set, and can produce all kinds of random RF noise. So for ground operations indoors, I use copper braiding from shielding. It's much more flexible, so it's easier to maneuver it and bend it and twist it, and it doesn't break if you twist it too much. For the outside, I always use copper strapping, so just keep that in mind. Okay, once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2, Gulf Sierra. This is the Limar Technical Net. If anyone else has any questions of either a technical nature, or a science nature, or a medical nature, or any nature, give me your first name and your call sign.
W-S-2-N. W-S-2-N.
Yes, Paul. I'm getting another signal in from good old Pennsylvania's repeater, but yes, I heard you. What would you like to add?
Okay, yeah, sometimes when you key up out in Selden, it doesn't, we hear the other stations before we, you know, in Glen Oaks rather than Selden. Yeah, this has to do with an experiment that the NASA sent up to the space station that they want the astronauts to poke around with, and it's some kind of a one-cell organism. They sent it up on a Cygnus spacecraft last week. But, you know, I have the words here. I'll try to pronounce it. Physical arum, that's the first word, polysepium. So the first word is spelled P-H-Y-S-A-R UM Polycept. I wonder what, if you, you know, I've looked this thing up on the internet. From what I read, or they actually said on the NASA site, it's a one-cell thing. But it's big. I mean, it was a yellow thing. Maybe it was flat. And, you know, the NASA people were holding it up in the air. And I can't imagine something that big being a one-cell anything. Naturally, they're going to try to experiment with this thing, you know, up in zero-G. I don't know what they're going to do with it. But I can't imagine. Yeah, I mean, apparently this thing exists. Wonder the history of it, or what is this thing? Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I was unable to find it on Google, so at your leisure, send me a link, and I'd love to read about it. There's a little gotcha with giant, quote, single-celled organism. Clickbait just doesn't kind of mention up front. You got to actually read the teeny tiny print. What these really are they have multiple nuclei. So it's sort of like a colony of multicellular organisms where the cell wall has dissolved. So it's this big huddle of cellular material with could be hundreds, if not thousands, of separate nuclei with DNA in them that all operate as sort of separate cells, even though they're congealed into one big cell. So it's a fascinating type of evolution, and they probably want to see somehow what low gravity exposure does to it, good, bad, or indifferent. There are things that are called single-celled macroscopic objects that you can see. But if you really look into the details, like I said, it's not like there's one nucleus that it's just some giant amoeba or something. It's a different kettle of fish.
Okay. Let me put this thing together. I'll send it over to you. And then let me know what you think. I didn't get much information from the NASA site, but I'll send you what I got. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. I just picked one up. I will put it on my link page. It came out of Popular Science. It says the blob, formerly known as Cesarum polycephalum, is a type of single-celled slime mold that has fascinated scientists for years. They say it can heal itself, smell and find food, and even solve mazes. That's better than some people I know. And it also has more than 700 sexes. Gee, that's probably more than we have now. So now it's gone to space. So it's an interesting article. It's a slime mold. Again, my guess would be once I read down far enough, it probably also has thousands of different nuclei with DNA in it as well. So it's another fascinating touch of evolution. But I will post this journey or spacehead report when I have the time to do that. So, it's a slime mold.
Okay. I'm wondering what purpose is this one cell thing. I'll call it an animal or a mold. What purpose would it serve on this planet? You know, reminds me of something that, you know, came in from the Andromeda strain or something. So, it went by quick. They talked about it on one of the NASA conferences, but it went by so quick that, you know, I thought they were kidding. Back to you, Rael. I'll turn back over to you.
Okay, I mean, it's almost like the guy who wrote the article just listened to me kind of make stuff up as a possible reason. What the fourth paragraph in, it says, the blob is an exciting two-in-one venture. Quote, our aim is to investigate the effect of microgravity on slime mold behavior, especially exploration behavior, but also growth. Audrey de Souture, a slime mold specialist. How would you like to be a slime mold specialist? And director of research of the French National Center for Science Research, a partner institution in this experiment, according to Vice. But the real main objective of this object is to engage kids in interesting, exciting scientific experiments. So it's a bit of a PR thing. As unfortunately,